Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, where I interview entrepreneurs about how they built their businesses. One of the reasons why I started Mixergy is that I have a love for business. I love to see how startups start, how businesses grow, how entrepreneurs take ideas from their heads and turn them into reality. And when I went to school, even when I took business classes, that passion just wasn't satisfied enough. It was too much of the mundane, too much of the things that don't really apply to life. And I always had this vision that the stuff that I like to study on my own would be accessible to me and I could study it in a more formal way. And if school wasn't the way, then someone needs to create that way. And partially I contributed to that using Mixergy, where we do interviews and courses. And partially I've been watching other people do it. And one of the companies that I've watched over the years do it really well is a company called Skillshare. They started out with these in-person events, which kind of reminded me like a more professional version of the Learning Annex. I'm looking at you, Michael, to see if you recognize that reference and if you're smiling or pissed that I made it, which I thought had a really solid foundation and at times went a little bit off the rails, depending on the kind of speakers and teachers that they had. And I loved that they started off with this in-person event. And I thought, man, they're going to actually separate themselves from the online pack by going in person and not doing another online thing. And then they pivoted, which tells me that there was a challenge in going offline, and I'm curious about what that was. Since then, they've grown and grown and grown, and I'm curious about how they did that, and I want to find out all about the business of Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community for creators. I've got the co-founder of the company with me. His name is Michael Karjanapakorn. Michael Karjanapakorn. I told you I practiced it so much before we started, and then you and I had some tech issues, and the practice went away. So Michael Karjanapakorn is the founder. He's here to talk about it. This interview is sponsored by two great companies you've heard me talk about forever. The first is going to help you close more sales. It's called Pipe Drive. And the second will host your website, right? It's called HostGator. But first, Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me. Great.
You know what? I'm curious about what your revenues are. What are you guys doing now?
Yeah, so maybe start with some high level metrics. We're about 3.5 million users. We have about 17,000 online classes, 5,000 teachers, and then we have over 100,000 subscribers. So we're easily clearing over about $1 million a month right now in recurring revenue.
100,000 subscribers, each paying like I am, $10 a month, and that gets you to $12 million a year.
Yeah, so it's either users can pay us $50 a month or $100 for the year. So you can choose which plan you want to go into.
Wait, isn't it $10 a month?
No, we increased the price this year as we increase the value for the platform.
So 15 a month.
Yeah, it's 15 a month, or I guess roughly comes out to like $8 and some change per month if you pay up front for a year.
Okay. That goes to show how much I pay attention to recurring fees and iTunes payments.
If you signed up before we increased the price, you're still locked in into the overhead.
Now, so, you have tons of courses. How many courses do you now have on the site?
About 17,000 courses, mostly professional within creative business, tech, and lifestyle. It's kind of our four major categories.
And Michael, anyone could create a course. Do you share the revenue with the course creators?
Yeah, so it's completely open. So in that way, it works similar to YouTube. And then we pay out a royalty. We have a royalty pool. We take a percentage of our revenue on any given month, put into a royalty pool, and that gets distributed out to all the teachers based on how many minutes were consumed by the students.
I see. You know what? The people at lynda.com years ago told me that was their model too, that they were taking a percentage. They even told me what the percentage was. I forget right now, and gave it out. They were very private about it. They told me, Andrew, we're going to tell you so that you go into your interview with Lynda knowing this stuff, but you can't mention it unless you research it and find it somewhere else. We just want you to be prepared, but we can't reveal it. I don't know why that was such a secret. But the model makes sense. What's the percentage of the revenue that you guys split with the teachers?
Yeah, so this is all public. So an average anywhere between like 30 and 50%. So it falls into that range.
Okay. All right. I'm curious about how you got here. I feel like you finally found your mojo. Am I right? As a business?
Yeah, we definitely hit our stride. I'd say the flywheel of momentum is definitely it's starting to pick up even more so than it has ever.
Okay, I want to find out about what that flywheel is, but let's go back a little bit and just get to know you. You're a guy who was born in Virginia, but you were raised where?
born in Virginia, but raised in Korea. And then moved back to Virginia when I was in middle school.
Why were you raised in Korea?
So my dad was in the military. I think part of the reason was to just kind of raise us, you know, because I'm half Korean and my dad from Thailand. They kind of wanted to raise us in Asia so we can kind of see their culture and really get, you know, exposed to that side of, you know, our family.
Now, most people think that entrepreneurship is this weird thing that someone else can be a part of, and it's hard for them to open their eyes to the possibilities because they just hadn't been exposed to it. It was always their boss or a friend or someone they read about who was an entrepreneur, never someone close to them. You had the opposite experience. Your family just kept being entrepreneurial. Talk about some of the businesses they started and how you attempted to help them with those businesses.
Yes, there's probably two interesting things out of my experience. One, which you could talk about in a second, is like how that paved the way for, like, you know, my interests and passion in education and learning. The other is more on the entrepreneurial startup side. So this one, our family moved us back to the U.S., obviously, first, you know, generation immigrant. You know, pretty much essentially what your family does is, like, they by necessity, they have to be, like, entrepreneurs. So I got to kind of get exposed to that whole side at a very young age. So seeing all the ups and downs, seeing them start businesses, seeing some of them be successful, some of them fail. Like, to me, like, you know, this is kind of like, you know, early days of the internet. Like, that's just kind of what I thought was, like, normal. Like, I just thought that that's what all families go through. So I think I kind of started developing, like, a much better understanding of small businesses and entrepreneurship at an early age, and just seeing how much work goes into building companies and see how hard my parents work to, you know, put food on the table.
They had a gift store at the mall, seafood takeout store, other things constantly. Why were they shifting so many stores? Why didn't they just have one thing that they did their whole careers?
Yeah, I think for them it was, you know, most of the businesses they started were either like a business that existed that they took over or something that they started. And I just don't think they ever scaled to where it could have, nor did I think that was their ambition. It was just more about, like, you know, starting a company, and that was the only place, you know, that would employ them, essentially. So they really had no choice.
Okay. And you told our producer, look, I'll be open with you. I had a bunch of ideas for my family for what they could do. We implemented them and none of them worked. What was it about your ideas at the time that didn't work? Obviously, you've gotten better as an entrepreneur. What was it about the early attempts that weren't so good?
I mean, I was like 12, 13, you know, like I was like 14 years old, and you know, you're working there, you know, like some of it could be like a pricing, some of it could be like a new product, and you're just testing things here and there. But, you know, I was just very young, and I was just very inexperienced. Like, and, you know, a lot of the business they started, there weren't things that I actually knew a lot of information about. But I think just seeing that, and I think just being exposed to that, you just learn so much, especially when you're working there too.
Yeah, I remember I worked at my dad's store. My big suggestions were always about how to add more computers to their store, and I realized it wasn't going to sell them anymore. It was just going to cost more money. But I had a passion for adding more computers. And this is before Square and all those other iPad-based options were available. So it was just, let's get a computer in here. And then the other suggestion I had was, let's get the hell out of this business. I hated going to my dad's store and having to be there weekends. I hated that somebody always had to mind the frickin' store. You know, the day before Thanksgiving, you'd have to be there. The day of Thanksgiving, you'd have to be there because you never know when someone's going to shop. And if they just buy like $100 worth of stuff, that's $100 you didn't have.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely had that same experience. It was like nights and weekends, and, you know, if they needed to take time off, it was like, you know, it was on us to kind of man the store while, you know, at the same time, you know, they're working like 12, 14, 16 hours a day. So, you know, just see how much hard work goes into it. So,
That too. You know what? So for me, my family was part of the Middle Eastern group of people who would open stores up in the ghetto of New York. And they worked hard. They would do like 10-hour days. Then these Koreans would come in, fresh from Korea, from South Korea, and these guys would work 12, 14-hour days. It was really just impossible to compete with someone who would work that hard in their store and whose family wouldn't bitch and moan like we did about showing up to the store. And ultimately, those guys ended up winning, and the people who of my dad's generation ended up having to move on to something else. That's just insane amount of hours, though.
I mean, definitely learned that from my parents. Like, a lot of people ask me where I get a lot of, you know, grit and resilience. It's, you know, definitely from my parents for sure.
All right. So you had this experience in school that kind of led you to a love for learning that led you then to create Skillshare. And I want to just talk on about one story that happened that gives us a sense of what education was like for you. You had this professor who walked into the classroom, introduced himself, and then he said, "Your first assignment is gum." And then what did he do after he said gum, G-U-M?
He walked out. That's it. That was it.
And then what are you supposed to do with that?
I had no idea. It was our first class. It was the first day of school. It was our first class with a pretty iconic teacher. Like, he helped create the brand Nike, and the class he was teaching was just around creative thinking. So you're like going there, you're like, okay, he walks in and he walks out. And essentially what we ended up learning throughout that class is every week he would give you a prompt, and you can, and then the following week you had 1 minute to present anything. It could be anything you wanted. But obviously the more creative, the better. And I remember pretty vividly that first class, people like made sculptures, people like invented gum, people, you know, it was like someone made a 60-second video about gum. It was just like, wow, and I think him giving us just enough guidance, but without too much handholding, was really helpful. I remember like the first couple days, everyone's asking each other what you're supposed to do. And people like, screw it, let's just go make something and create something. And it's a creative class, so let's, and then. But the flip side of that class is like, you would present for a minute, he would tear you apart for a minute.
So you Why? Also Why was that helpful for him to tear you apart for a minute?
Because ideas were pretty terrible, and he would be very blunt about them. He would give you very direct feedback, and he was right most of the time. And you just start developing a thick skin, but you don't. And then you start developing the skin, then you don't fall in love with your ideas, and you start listening, and then you go back and you tinker again, and you come back with a stronger idea.
Yeah,
and then that gets stronger and stronger, and you just realize that ideas are a dime a dozen, and you do need to get the feedback and collaborate. So, like, just that exercise was like pretty transformative for me as a student.
Okay, the idea for Skillshare came to you originally when you were working with 4th and 5th graders, and you were kind of frustrated about what?
I think I would say I was frustrated with the current education system. So, our family was here, and also you think. Pretty much any culture, especially Korean culture, it was all about school. Everything was about education. And everything I did was around getting a great school. And I realized I graduated, it wasn't really what I wanted to do. It wasn't really what I expected. So I spent half my life working so hard. Right around Hurricane Katrina, moved to New Orleans and volunteered at a charter school. And I kind of saw that same, determination. And this time it was with a bunch of 4th and 5th graders, and their goal was very similar to mine, which is go to school, graduate, and your life will change. You'll become successful. So I kind of, one, got frustrated with that, but also, like, I really enjoyed working with them, and I really saw the power of education, right? That 80% dropout rate, so, like, which is insane. They're trying to turn that to 80% college graduation rate. But I realized that working with a bunch of 4th and 5th graders, we have to wait 10, 15 years to see the impact. And that's when I started thinking about, I have a personal experience. I saw the power of it and how it can change lives. Could we do that on the internet at a much bigger scale, faster? And that's when I started thinking about the idea behind Skillshare.
So here's the part that shocks me about you as a person. You sound so entrepreneurial. You come from a family where entrepreneurship was just part of life. And you go to class and school where you're pushed beyond your boundaries to just do what you want. And still, you confessed to our producer, you said, look, I felt that I wasn't ready to be an entrepreneur. I needed an MBA in startups. I needed to do something. Why did you feel that way? Why did you feel like you weren't ready?
Yeah, so I've always been pretty entrepreneurial, but I also didn't want to work on the wrong thing. I was watching, observing a lot of people that were working on ideas that never really amounted to anything, and they're just spinning in circles. And I wanted to learn. I was very hungry. So, after New Orleans, I moved to New York, and I worked at a startup called Behance with a guy named Scott Belsky, who's now a partner at Benchmark. And I wanted to learn because I knew that when I started my company, and I wanted it to be really successful. But the other side of it is, like, I never worked in tech. I was, used computers my entire life, but I never knew how to build a website. I didn't know what it meant to build a platform. And I had an opportunity to work directly for the founder as employee number five and learn how to do everything. And I would say that experience is directly attributed to the success of me as an entrepreneur and Skillshare for sure. Behance was one of those unique opportunities where, there are very few websites per, era that actually hit network effects and work. And I always tell a lot of students, like, you can learn a lot from failing, but I think you learn 10x more by, being somewhat successful. And a lot of people underestimate, the experience you get at working in a place that's successful and being able to punch above your weight and take on more responsibility and learn. And I feel like I've learned what most people learn 10 years at a failing startup and 1 year at a successful one.
I see. So where I might be dismissive of that and say, hey, these are imposter syndrome thoughts, you're saying, actually, it led to something really useful. You learned a lot by working for Behance. That's an incredible company, an incredible group of people to be a part of. I think you also worked at Facebook, if I remember right.
Yeah, I worked at another company called Hot Potato that ended up getting acquired by Facebook. So I went from Skillshare to Hot Potato, got recruited there to lead a product team. And at Behance, I kind of was the jack of all trades. I did everything. And yeah. I really liked the product and had an opportunity to lead the product team with a lot more responsibility and focus in one area. And we got acquired by Facebook. And then from there, the idea for Skillshare was, kind of marinating for many years and felt it was the right time.
And then you met Malcolm Ong. Am I pronouncing his last name right?
Yeah. So I met Malcolm just throughout the New York tech scene. And yeah, we would always just, meet up and grab dinner and just talk through ideas and talk about product. And we did the founder dating thing for like 1 to 2 years before we started the company.
1 to 2 years. But one of the things that he added, and you did too, to the conversation was a couple of personal rules. You were going to start this business, and one rule had to do with coding. What was that?
So one rule was around coding where we couldn't really physically build it. So we weren't going to, we could build it. Between his skill set and mine, we could build anything, but we didn't want to build a product that no one used because I worked at Behance and we did launch a new product that no one used, and we spent 9 months building it, and I said, just definitely don't want to do that. And we put a financial cap on what we would spend on the company. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Within those two constraints, it just made us laser focused on customers. Like, we were so focused on customer development that I think that attributed a lot to the early formation of the company.
And so you created Eventbrite events. You taught the programs yourself. Yeah. One of the first classes that you taught was what?
Playing poker. So poker. I was a competitive poker player. You can still see, if you go to skillshare1.eventbrite.com, I think you can see, like, and you go 2, 3, 4, 5, you can see all the first classes. They're still pretty large.
I remember this part of your story partially because Fred Wilson is an investor and he's so vocal and was much more so in the beginning about Skillshare and what he's talked to you guys about. You know what? I actually don't see that. No, I do see it. Play poker like the pros. Yeah, and I could.
But what we're trying to validate is, we talked to a lot of people and the number one consensus of why Skillshare would not work is that people can't teach. You have to go to school, teaching is very hard. I had to, so we just wanted to prove out that anyone can teach and people would actually sign up. And that's the only thing that we focused on for the first.
Can someone who's good at something like poker teach it? And will someone go and learn from that person?
And pay for it.
Yeah. And pay for it. Now, in New York, Learning Annex was huge for a long time. They essentially had that. But they didn't want the average person. I guess they did. They were okay with the average person teaching in some cases. What they wanted especially was like Howard Stern's producer to talk about how to produce a radio show. They wanted the person who had the name to teach the thing, partially so that people can just go and gawk at these minor celebrities. Was that at all an inspiration?
No, so Learning Annex wasn't an inspiration. I mean, it was a company that existed at the time. Like, for us, huge believers in decentralization and platforms. So we wanted, to turn every single city into a campus and every address into a classroom and every single person into a teacher and student. And if you layer that in to pretty much every square foot of the world, that turns the whole world into a big school.
I see.
Grand vision, and then boom, tons of challenges.
Okay. And so you were thinking, hey, Andrew's got this office here. why doesn't Andrew start inviting people into the office to teach about how to do interviews, to teach about how to have a conversation? Got it. All right. It didn't work. We're going to talk about it in a second. First, let me talk about my first sponsor. It's a company called HostGator. I feel like I got a sneeze, but it's not coming out. So I'm just going to go right through. Here's the thing. Every time I talk, I'll be honest with you, Michael. Every time I talk about HostGator, frankly, any hosting company, man, are people so religious about their hosting companies? Do you feel that strongly? Like if I asked you what your hosting company was, would you be up at arms if I told you there are others out there? You don't seem like it.
Yeah, no.
Man, they're too... Huh?
I mean, I offer just simplicity. So whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
The two things that people get really passionate religiously about, it's the CRM that they use, and then the hosting company. And both of my sponsors today are one is a hosting company and the other is a CRM. But here's the deal, guys. Look, if you're listening to Michael tell his story, one of the things that should stand out to you is that he just started with as basic thing as possible. He didn't recreate Eventbrite so that he can validate his idea and get his original customers. He just said, you know what, Eventbrite's up there. I'm going to go with it. The other thing that should stand out for you is what he learned in school, where if you have the openness, the freedom to experiment like he did in that classroom, and there are others that he took, but like that classroom where the professor walked in and just said gum. When you get that kind of freedom to experiment with no penalties for failure, good things come out. And more than that, you stretch your creative muscles. So what I'm going to encourage is anyone who's listening who has an idea, I want you to go take it to HostGator.com/Mixergy and just go implement it. For a few bucks a month, you're going to have a canvas that you can put anything on. And if you don't have an idea at all, I'm going to urge you to go into HostGator.com/Mixergy. Just sign up for their basic package and experiment with installing WordPress on it with one-click install. And give yourself a canvas that you're going to challenge yourself to fill up with something. I don't know what it could be. It could be, look at one of your ideas, Michael. You started something called WorldSeriesOfGood.com years ago. That site is down, right? But it was this idea that people who were playing poker should donate part of their winnings to a good cause. That's a fantastic idea. You raised over $150,000 from what I see here online from really big people like Phil Ivey. There's the thing that could happen, guys, if you're listening to me, when you have a blank canvas and the willingness to experiment with it. For me, I just had the ability to just go install WordPress really easily. I installed it. I said, what if I start doing interviews? And I started doing interviews and boom, it became a passion project that's now gone on for almost 10 years. So when you go to HostGator, I do not get paid any extra if you go for the higher level program or the lower level program. I should be encouraging you to go for the cheapest option out there. Instead, I'm going to suggest you go for the second cheapest option. It's called the baby plan and you'll see it there. And the reason is one simple thing. Unlimited domains. That means that you could just go and keep installing WordPress on tons of different sites, come up with an idea on Monday, be okay with it not going anywhere by Thursday, and then Friday come up with another idea. Give yourself the room to experiment, and when you go sign up at HostGator.com/Mixergy, you're going to get unmetered disk space, unmetered bandwidth. They're going to give you tons of templates, 4,500 to be exact, 4,500 templates so you can easily design your site. They're even going to give you, I was going to say unlimited email address, they'll give you that too, but they're even going to give you a $100 AdWords offer and $50 search credit with Bing and Yahoo, which means they're going to make it easy for you to get the word out about your site. Go to HostGator.com/Mixergy. I promise. In fact, I don't even have to promise. They guarantee that you're going to love it. If you don't love it, they'll give you your money back. Okay. Coming back to the story, Michael, you had this idea. The thing was starting to take off. People are actually going into your Eventbrite program. What about teaching teachers? I found that it's hard to get people to teach what they know. How did you get them to teach what they know?
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time in the early days teaching teachers how to teach. I think, so we worked with every single teacher. We also worked with, we're like the community manager on the student side. And we kind of just helped teachers teach. And the way we did that is we focused a lot on what their skill sets were, what they're passionate about. And we kind of started creating like our version of a playbook that anyone could use to teach. And it was a really simple like organization system. And we worked with them as kind of like a thought partner to help them think through and structure their outline. And it worked fairly well.
You mean you would give them their outline, you would coach them individually, and then whatever you learned by coaching them would go into the playbook.
I would call this phase we rolled our sleeves up and brute forced it. So most of the teachers, we designed the curriculums with them, but we probably did most of the legwork and we didn't wait for people. We just kind of nudged them and that turned into a flywheel, and then other people started to do it, and then we built a platform, and then people did it on their own, and then started growing.
What's the flywheel part of this? What's the part that kind of goes on its own? At this stage, not today, but the stage that we're talking about right now.
Yeah, so just the two-sided network effect. So we realized that the biggest constraint was on the supply side, which were teachers, and if we could get teachers, it would bring the demand side, and then some of those people would end up teaching, and then that flywheel will start spinning. And the faster that spun, the bigger we got, and the more powerful the platform would become as well as it got bigger. So,
because every teacher had an incentive to tell their friends to come watch, to tell their audiences to come watch and participate, and then you guys also would allow, would help them get more people to their program because you had this group of learners in each city. Okay, so that worked well in New York. You then came to San Francisco. Did you raise money next, or did you go to Boston?
We raised money before we launched in New York, and then we did New York and then SF, and then those two worked really well. We did Boston, which was okay, and then when we tried to expand out of Boston, that's when everything kind of started breaking.
Raising money, hard or easy?
I think it's always hard. Maybe some rounds are easier than others, or maybe raising portions of it are easy, but it's always pretty challenging. With the real exception is if you're in crypto, it's pretty easy right now. But outside of that, it's always pretty tough.
And so how did you get money from, why don't we go to Fred Wilson? I read him talk about you guys a lot. He is a marquee name as an investor. What did you do to get to raise money from them?
So in the early days, it was really hard because, this is pre, startup, boom, and there weren't a lot of education companies, and most investors weren't touching education companies at all because they got burned at this in the previous era. So Chris Dixon actually led our seed round. So that
he did.
Yeah. So we got through to Chris Dixon because a guy named Zach Klein, who started Vimeo, recruited me to go work at Hot Potato. So he already kind of saw me go through that, and he was asking what I was doing next. I kind of walked him through this idea. And he loved it, and he kind of became our biggest advocate and brought Chris Dixon in. That gave us enough capital to build the first product and launch in those three cities. And while we're doing that, our growth was like pretty accelerating, and that's when Fred Wilson and Albert Wenger came in along with Spark Capital to do our Series A. So all this happened in less than a year, so it happened very, very fast.
Wow, okay. Yeah, Chris Dixon was, especially at the time, one of the best early stage investors. I think when I interviewed him, I researched him, and he had the best track record at the time. So I get it. And then now you had the money to start in New York. You moved to San Francisco. What happened in Boston? It sounds like Boston was much more painful than I ever realized for you guys.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say any of the cities were painful. I think what it really came down to, the model just didn't work, when it scaled, and it just broke pretty fundamentally.
What do you mean? Here's what you told our producer. You said, we expanded to Boston and everything fell apart, leading to the trough of shit for the next 3 years. Yeah. I like that openness, by the way, but put some flesh on that. What happened?
So it wasn't really about Boston. It was more about like, the model was working and then it just broke. And what we realized, and when I say it wasn't Boston, it's like at that point, we probably had like a year to 15 months worth of data. And then if you kind of started looking at the metrics and start modeling out what the business could look like, we just noticed a huge fundamental flaw, which is if you're a local marketplace or platform, you either want a high price with low frequency, or you want like high frequency, low price, right? So Uber is a great example of that. People use Uber all the time. It's like 10, 15 bucks. But we're like $25 a class and people use us every 3 months, and we're taking pretty low transaction fee. I think it's like 10 or 20%. So you do the math, like it just doesn't, the business just doesn't scale.
I see.
It was less about Boston. It's just at that point, we were planning to expand aggressively. The early data started coming in from New York, so we had about a year's worth of data, and just realized that if that's the best, New York is the most dense city in the U.S. that this model could work, and that was the best it could do. And even if we optimized it a little bit more, it wouldn't have gotten that much better. The math just didn't work out where at scale it would have been a profitable business.
Why didn't you increase the price? I'm thinking about even going to a comedy club. it costs more and they pack more people in. Why didn't you say we're going to double the price and see if that works? We're going to charge a minimum of $75. That's kind of a night of entertainment and value, and we'll get better at promoting it and copywriting it and so on.
Because it was open, right? So the teachers priced it. I mean, we worked with them to try to increase the price, but it just never worked out. So I would say that was a big reason. Innovation was another reason. Like, everyone did a lecture in front of the classroom, very archaic way of teaching. So we looked at online as a white space for innovation. And then our mission, is really around providing access to learning. And we had people all around the world that wanted to take Chris Dixon's class, and they couldn't because they weren't in New York. So we thought online would allow us to fulfill our mission. So that's when we decided to pivot the business and move it online.
I want to spend a little bit more time, because you obviously made the right decision. It worked. But I want to understand how you got to it and why you dismissed other ideas or why they weren't a good fit. Like, I'm looking at General Assembly. They have teachers that are practitioners, but that they themselves pick and vet, and then they have longer, more in-depth programs. Why didn't you go in that direction and say, you know what, not everyone should teach. Some people are especially good at it. We're going to partner with the ones who are the best, allow anyone to create a class for $25, but the best of the best we're going to pick, they're going to be more partner-like, and we're going to charge more and offer more with them. Why didn't you go in the higher-end direction?
Because that didn't fulfill our mission, right? So we didn't want to restrict anyone from learning, right? So GA fits that high price with low frequency, right? So I'm assuming it costs like $5,000 to $10,000 to less, and you do that once in your life, right? And it's pretty restrictive to a lot of people. So we ruled that off as an option because the mission for the company has stayed true since we started it. And that allowed us to make a lot of these decisions pretty easily.
I see. That if you know you want to get as many people as possible, increasing the price is not the answer. Keeping the frequency at 3 to 4 times a year is not the answer. It has to be something else. And then the natural next step is that. You know what? I heard that Jamie Siminoff, who I knew in LA well and has now had a hit with Ring, that he says that one of the reasons why Ring works well is that internally they have a mission. They're not the doorbell company. They're not the camera company. They're the security company. And so if you give them an idea for a new type of use for a webcam, they turn it down unless it fills their mission of security. And when you have a clear mission like that, it helps make decisions so easy that he thinks he has an unfair advantage.
Yeah, so I guess when you just ask the question, it's like, having such a clear mission allows you to say no to like so many ideas and narrow it down. So we didn't really have a lot of options from there. So we did explore a lot of ideas, but moving online was just so obvious. And we also looked at the strength of the company. A lot of our background was in product engineering and content. And we also looked at, are we an operational real estate business, or are we a product company and a tech company that can build a platform?
Yeah.
Decided to go that route. So it was our mission aligned with our strengths and the opportunity. And we just felt like online would have been, a better fit for, what we could achieve in the space.
I get that. The other thing that strikes me is that people don't want to learn on a monthly, more frequently than a quarterly basis, which is a realization that I accept, but I'm a little disappointed by. I remember when I was in school, my friends would go out every week to watch a rock show, to watch a local band play, to go to a dance club. And I always thought, as excited as you are by that, I get more excited when I learn a new skill, when I walk away knowing how to negotiate, when I walk away knowing how to remember something. Those are feelings that I get to not just enjoy in the moment when I learn it, but take away for the rest of my life. And if only all those educational programs could have some element of fun that the music shows have, that would really be the show. And if only people understood this, they would turn away from the comedy clubs and the rest and go for something more substantive. And it's disappointing that the world didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, it's just human beings and all their best parts and the worst parts.
You know what, as I was saying it, I noticed you smile, and I'm wondering, do you smile because you recognize this in this, or because you feel the dorkiness of it, which I feel today, the dorkiness of that thought?
No, it's the former. I you're literally verbatim saying exactly what I would say. I always say, the best investment anyone can make is in themselves.
Yeah.
You choose where you want to spend your time and where you want to make an investment, And obviously, like, much like anyone else in the world, I love going to comedy shows and, you know, having fun. At the same time, it's like, I love investing in myself. And that also tie back to the mission. It's like, there has, you know, there are other people out there that are not in New York that now have access to the internet.
Right.
And they work hard and they can learn these skills and they can start a business or work at a company or, you know, change their lives. And like that, you know, that is what kind of has like motivated and inspired me to work on this as long as I have.
So I pivoted from doing offline events where I would bring in speakers and I would interview them in person to online. I straddled both worlds for a while there, but for me it was fairly easy. For you, you decided to straddle both worlds too. You kept the offline world going, and you also did the online stuff. Why did you do that, and how did that turn out? Let's start with why did you do that? Why did you continue the in-person events while you went online?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the big lesson learned from that experience is like when you make a decision, you're either 100% or zero. You can't be 99, right? So 99 is kind of like, oh, we're making that decision, but we're also going to do this other thing. And every moment since then, it's always been binary, especially on big decisions. There's no going down the middle because the middle is gray. It's murky. You're not really making a decision by doing that. And I think part of it was like 99.99% we were going online, but 0.01% it was just like a safety net. Like if that doesn't work out, we saw this other thing. But in hindsight, like that business wasn't working either. What ended up happening is like we had two different code bases. We had like an 8-person product engineering design team that was maintaining two websites. We had two communities. It was just a mess. And I wouldn't even say today we're still paying kind of that tech debt.
So what do you mean by that? That to this day you feel like you're still paying the technical debt?
Oh, just so we had two different code bases. So
it still exists on the site.
Still exists in some fashion. Like, you know, most of it's gone now. But you know, what we should have done is kind of what ClassPass did, right? So before that, they were called Classtivity. Completely deleted that business, rebranded, and came out with ClassPass. I think that was a great lesson. If you're going to pivot your business. And also a lot of users are confused. They're like, oh, is this Skillshare the local business? And we have this online thing. So, but, you know, I would say every experience since then, it's always been, you know, when we have to make a big decision, we make that with a lot of conviction and we go all in.
I didn't realize that ClassPass was Classtivity. That was a Techstars company. So Techstars has a huge win in them.
Yeah. It was called Classtivity. Also didn't work. They were also local, but it was more of a local marketplace for classes. So I heard about it because we're, you know, planning on working with them to list some of our classes. It was basically like a Kayak for classes. And they hit the same problem we hit, which is frequency and price. So they realized that a subscription model would work better, and then they launched ClassPass. And we realized subscription model would work better online, and we launched Skillshare, the online version.
I see. There it is. 2013. Wow, this is not even that long ago. 2013, there's a TechCrunch article about them. Classtivity launched out of Techstars back in June of last year with the promise to connect New Yorkers with any leisure or fitness class they could imagine with expert reviews, pricing information, schedules, etc. Turns out finding a class isn't as difficult as actually going to a class, which is why most fitness-based business models revolve around packages. And so their next transition was to a subscription model. And only after that didn't really work did they switch from Classtivity to a brand new product, which is a subscription that gives you access to a number of classes. I see. Wow, that's really interesting. I didn't connect it at all. Okay, let me take a break here and then talk about now that you found your thing, how did you even get it to take off? How did you get in a world where, frankly, online classes are everywhere now, and they always were. In the last 4 or 5 years, they were everywhere. You could go to YouTube and you can find them. How did you guys get customers? How did you get them to commit to a monthly fee, etc.? First, I've got to tell everyone about a company called Pipedrive. Again, many people are going to say, I have my own CRM. I love it. Whatever your CRM is, I'm not going to tell you guys to turn away from it. What CRM do you use personally? I shouldn't be talking about it in an ad for Pipedrive, Michael, but let me hear what you're using. I'm curious. Do you use a CRM?
I actually don't really use a CRM, but this sounds like a pretty good product.
Who's right? I'll be honest. privately, the best CRM that I found is the stinking thing that comes with my iPhone. Because if I'm talking to someone immediately after I'm done, I like to go into my iPhone notes and just write a note about them. And then I could come back the next time I talk to them. When I look for their phone number, I see, oh, they're moving houses. My first question, so I could act like a human being before getting into business, is, hey, how's the move going? Right? And then they tell me whatever else is going on with their kids' lives. I write it down and then I come back. That's not the kind of CRM that Pipedrive is. Frankly, there are tons of different CRMs for that kind of application, and the one in your phone might just be the best that you can use for it. Here's where Pipedrive is really good, and it's only good for this. If you have a set of processes or want to have a set of organized processes for closing a sale, Pipedrive excels in that. They are focused on that, and they require that. And if you say, I want to pay you, can I do other stuff with it? They're going to say, you can do whatever you want, but frankly, it's not going to be good. Keep your money. They focus on that. As soon as anyone who's listening to me, or even you, Michael, decide that you're going to sign up for Pipedrive, as soon as you get in, one of the first things they're going to tell you, maybe even the first thing they're going to tell you to do, is write down the steps that it takes from taking a stranger to closing them as a customer. What are those steps? And each one of those steps gets its own column. And then they say, okay, now find a potential customer, create a card, and we're going to put that card for that potential customer in the leftmost column. And then we're going to kind of nag you until you take your next step and the next step and the next step until you close the sale. And every time you take a step, you move the card one column to the right, you get the sense of satisfaction, and you get to see that people are moving and progressing towards a sale. And if you're doing it individually, congratulations, it's going to work for you. You're going to see more sales. But if you're starting to hire other people to help with your sales team, you could say to them like I do, hey, you, I need you to help with column number 3. That's not something that's a real sales task. It's just a follow-up process. You're in charge, Samantha, of column number 3. Steve, you're in charge of column number 7 because that's more of a technical thing, and I want you to follow up with them and show them that we have a team here. Then you start assigning a column to other people. And beyond that, you get stats. I like it as a team leader here at Mixergy that I get to see stats on how other people on my team are performing. Are they actually closing sales? Are they moving deals down the pipeline? Or are they just lazy? Or are they actually just afraid of making calls? I need to know the stats, and then I could get on a call with them and say, hey, what's going on here? All right, if that's the kind of mindset that you guys have out there, anyone who has it, I urge you to do what so many people at Mixergy have done, and that is go and just try it. Go play with the freaking thing. Go to pipedrive.com/Mixergy, and it's going to force you to create your process. Here's what I'm going to suggest when you do it. Don't create the best process. Don't create the right process. Start with a theory of what your process is of closing sales. Then start adding people to it. And when things don't work, when you realize, hey, you know what? After I send someone an invitation, I should follow up. Create another column called follow-up. My friend Noah Kagan says that he gets 50% of all of his sales with the follow-up email. The first email gets ignored. 50% of his sales come because he sends a follow-up email. You hear something like that? Add another column to your sales process. Follow up with people who don't respond. All right, go to pipedrive.com/Mixergy. They're going to give you 14 days free, 25% off for 3 months thereafter. Frankly, they shouldn't even have to give you 25% off. Their price is super low. They're a company that really should be doubling prices. Pipedrive.com/Mixergy. Really good software. It's one of those things that if anyone signs up for it, I know that they're going to say, Andrew is helpful in my life. For the next 10 years, they're going to say that. Good for me. All right. Now, you have this whole online thing. How do you get anyone to come? You know what? Forget. How do you justify online? I'm a little hung up on this. In a world where so much is free, when you're going to your investors, when you're talking internally, how do you say, we're going to do an online thing when you look around and see that people are teaching for free?
Yeah, I think that's when we started really thinking about like what is going to be our moat, what's our differentiation, where are we going to add to you? And that's essentially how we started developing our strategy. So we said we wanted to create an open platform, and because the world's moving so quickly, the only way you can learn those skills is if someone else can teach them as quickly as they're popping up in the world. So even though there's a bunch of free content out there, we felt that we would always have the most cutting edge. Second is quality. So on one end of the spectrum, you have YouTube, that's free. On the other end, you might have college. And we felt that there's always a need for someone to learn those skills and not have to waste a lot of time searching for all that information online. So we definitely wanted to offer them. And three, we just wanted to pack in as much value into a subscription. So we wanted we didn't want anyone to say that I didn't learn anything that changed my life from this
culture. So, all right, I get that. Now, do you do the same thing you did when you had an offline marketplace, which is focus on the creators and know that when you have a lot of creators, more people are going to come in?
Yeah, so we focused on the supply side again, and we essentially did the same thing all over again. So just a lot of brute force, roll your sleeves up, and just, you know, one by one, just get the teachers on the platform. So when we start with like 10 teachers and we grew to like 20 to 50, and now we have, you know, 5,000 teachers on the platform. So it starts small, but then it starts, you know, getting bigger and bigger over time.
I see, because I was checking out a water paint class. The woman who put it on, I have no idea whether she put it on today, last week, or 2 years ago. It's always going to be relevant. And once you have that on, you have another class that's offered. And she always makes money based on how many people watch her class, right?
Exactly.
So you get a bunch of creators. What was your best source for finding creators and getting them to actually create these programs?
Just reaching out to them. Literally, I mean, we could have used PipeDrive back then, but it was, you know, we'd go online, we'd find people that were very interesting, they had a following, and we'd reach out to them, and then same thing, we'd work with them on the curriculum and help them teach, and then rather than helping them find a space, we would help them with video, we'd put it on the platform, and then we would market it out. And that would start bringing the students, and then, you know, the two sides just started, you know, like every time that happens, think of it as like one flywheel that spins, and The first time you try to spin it, it's a lot of work. It's hard, and then over time, it gets easier and easier.
Because they have an incentive to promote it. But here's the thing: it's not a direct revenue. It's not. I hate to mention your competitors, but I want to understand this space really well, and so I'll be open. Udemy also has a similar program where anyone can teach, and if you sell a class on Udemy, you get the money that people pay for your class, and so there's a direct incentive to promote the class. Here, I might be recommending that people come take my class. And so I send them into Skillshare. They sign up for a Skillshare account. They watch 5 minutes of my class, or they get distracted and don't even do that. And then they end up watching, I don't know, you guys have Seth Godin on. You guys have the Buffer people on. You have a bunch of others. Then they end up getting all the money. And I made the referral and I sent them into Skillshare. So isn't that a challenge?
Well, there's a couple of things, you know. One is when you think about our competitors, we feel that the market, you know, what we, end of the day, it's just digital content. It's an MP4 file. And on the internet, anything that's where the marginal cost of distribution is zero, the price, you know, hits some type of floor. So while we do have a lot of competitors that are doing that model, I would say, you know, there was a time where people charged $1,000 for an online course. And now everything is on sale for $5, $10. And pretty soon, you know, that those prices will drop too, because I don't think consumers are going to be willing to pay that, especially if there are other, you know, platforms like Skillshare, which is more akin to Spotify than iTunes model, especially when it comes to digital content. And then our platform is like different from our competitors in a way where, you know, if you do bring a student, you do get paid, right? So you do get, you know, $10 for referring a new subscriber. But for our teachers, we just want them to focus on teaching. So, you know, there are a lot of people out there that don't have a huge online following, and we do send them a lot of students. And there are a lot of, Seth Godin is not our most successful teacher. He's our most famous one. But we have teachers that are making, you know, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 a month that were unknown, but they just happen to be really great teachers.
I'm assuming those guys are also teaching software, that when there's software to learn, they're businesses that will send their people in to go learn that, right?
Not necessarily. Like, you know, our we have classes within Creative Assistant Tech. We have software classes. You know, like our top teacher is like an animator. And the reason is very niche market. That information is not widely available. He's a great, phenomenal teacher. He's very active in his students and his community. And as a result, he's very, very successful. And we have other teachers that are teaching, like, let's say, you know, someone, you know, maybe software, when I was engaging, the content's really dry. They don't do as successful. Like, if you're teaching a class and like somebody can't pay attention, you know, like maybe you should think of a different way to teach, or, you know, make it more engaging, or, you know, and that allows.
But for the original person who's sending someone in, they get $10, so they don't even have to count on someone taking their class as long as it's a brand new potential customer, brand new person, send them over, say, go check out my class on Skillshare. The person signs up to take the class. If they watch 5 minutes, they get distracted, there's still a $10 commission.
Yes. And the cool part of our business today is, like, it was a really slow start, but once it hits scale, it becomes more powerful. Like, we're, you know, we had, you know, as this subscription pool gets bigger, you know, there are more payouts to teachers. We can take bigger bets on getting much bigger names onto the platform, very similar to Netflix. We started create our own original content if we wanted to. So it does become more powerful.
Did you start creating your own original content?
We do. I think we make a couple of classes a month right now, but you know, for us, we're looking to start working with bigger names now because obviously we have much bigger royalty pool. We're subscriptions, we feel more confident.
And the reason that some, I think that there are a couple of reasons why someone would do it. So say Tim Ferriss has a brand new book out. He's a name that would attract new students and get existing students to go watch him. He wants to promote the ideas in the book. And if you make it easy for him to be on your platform and teach, his number one thing is that now more people get exposed to his content, especially if they're learners, who then eventually some of them would go buy the book. The secondary, and it's probably not even a strong incentive, is that he gets paid for people who watch the course. That's the reason behind something like that, right?
For sure.
Now, if he expresses an interest, do you guys say, hey, this is Tim Ferriss, he's a celebrity, we're going to help him by bringing him into a studio or help him by giving him more support?
Yeah, we definitely do that.
What do you do? What's your process for taking a Tim Ferriss and helping him out?
Yeah, we have a content team, which consists of like film, you know, filmmakers, you know, education, and like account manager partnerships, and they would work with them and figuring out what he would want to teach, help them design. Literally the same thing we used to do in the early days, just at a much bigger scale.
I see. And so there'd be like a space here in San Francisco, I'm imagining. He would come in.
We mostly shoot on location, so it feels more like Vice than, you know, so it goes back to what you were saying earlier. It's a little bit more fun and inspirational when you can go to his apartment or follow him around or...
So you would send this, so you send the videographers over. Do you guys put together the material based on his book? Do you help him put together the outline of what to talk about?
Yeah.
Yeah, by the way, that beep beep was freaking Siri. I don't know what I said that suddenly made Siri wake up, but I want to go back and just hit rewind to see how startled I was by that. I see. Okay, so now I get a sense of how the business works. Let me see what else I didn't talk about. We talked about the flywheel. We talked about how you guys produce content and how you help people produce content. What else helped you get people in the door? Beyond the teachers themselves promoting their class, I'm looking through like SimilarWeb to get a sense of where you guys are getting traffic. And I don't see where it is. Where are people coming in? How are people discovering Skillshare?
Yeah, that's our secret sauce. No, I'm just kidding. I would say it's a little bit of everything. You know, it's like every single channel we tested, we iterated, we optimized, and we added a new one. And you know, over time, so early days was supply. Then we launched student referrals, so students started referring, and SEO started kicking in, and then we started building social following, and we started working with, you know, partners and influencers, and then we started doing podcasts, advertising. You know, it's like, you know, just you keep adding more and more channels and they start all working in unison together.
What's your framework for that? Are we talking, it sounds like what you're saying is very similar to Gabriel Weinberg, the guy from DuckDuckGo, his book Traction. It seems like that.
The early days, that book was, you know, pretty impactful. So we did have the bullseye strategy where we went all in on a few channels and one of them worked really well. And now that we have a full marketing team, it's like, you know, it's kind of like, they're testing everything.
I see. But in the beginning, it was, let's make a list of all the possible things that we could do. Let's figure out what is most likely to work for us. Let's experiment and then cut if it doesn't work.
Ours was all influencers.
So, influencers.
Yeah. So we've always had a very strong influencer strategy. So could be on the teaching side, they started working on helping people in this market. And we realized because we built such a great brand that a lot of influencers wanted to associate their brand with ours. And that's how we grew Skillshare.
Okay, so I read your Medium post, the one titled Passing the Baton, where you say, I'm not going to be the CEO anymore. Our COO is going to take over. I'm the guy who helped start the company, like the zero to one, start from nothing and get it to something. Now someone else who can grow the company needs to take over. I get that. I'm also sensing that beyond that, there's a personal reason why you want to step back. Talk to me about the personal side of the decision to not be the CEO of this company that you founded and worked so hard on.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was, you know, it's kind of like, I read an article that Reid Hoffman wrote about, I guess, him moving to this similar role, and obviously LinkedIn is much bigger than Skillshare. And it was a pretty objective decision. It's, when you think where the company needs to go and where my strengths are, you know, they didn't really overlap. It also felt like what the company really needs right now is a very strong operational background and experience that can kind of help scale it and get it to where it needs to go. That doesn't mean that I won't be the CEO in the future. or that I'm stepping away just means that it just means a different skill set to get to where it needs to go. And in order for me to make that decision, it's a lot of self-reflection. You know, this is my baby. I started it from the ground up. I've been working on it for 7 years. But I think that the right decision was to, especially to get to where we want to go over the next 3 years, it was definitely a different person to get with it.
So personally, what are you going to be doing? What's next for you? What's next for Michael?
So I'm still day-to-day at Skillshare. So, right now we're fundraising, so that consumes a lot of my time. I'm launching new products. So I'm kind of in charge of, all the new products we're launching, which is fun because it feels like an early stage startup again. And then whatever projects come up here and there. So I'll do things like this. But it gives me a lot more free time to just be a lot more creative and innovative and just think about, one, how to grow a business, and how we can continue to innovate, which aligns with my sweet spot and where my strengths are, what I actually enjoy doing, and where I get a lot of energy.
I do feel like online learning could use a rethought. We're still doing video the way that people used to do teaching. There isn't this, I saw more innovation for a while and now it seems a little flat is in coding. Coding is always about, I'm going to teach you, you're going to do it, you're going to see the result, or you're going to see that it's not working and we could keep updating. And I always thought that Mixergy would add more to it, that not, it wouldn't be a person teaching at students. And I'm sensing that you're playing around with that. I think Mavericks is a program like that. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so it's one of the new products that came out of Skillshare. It's one that I'm leading, and it's very different. So it's 100% free. There are no teachers. There are no classes. Everything is project-based, learning, and everything's peer-to-peer. So we launched we started with three programs, one around product design, blockchain development, and data science. And we're launching that next month, hopefully. Or let me rephrase that and say Q1, just in case it gets delayed. But the idea is if you have access to internet, you should be able to learn these skills and get a job or start a business and graduate in. And there should be no limitations on financials. And we do want 95% of people to drop out because we don't want it to be easy.
But that's the innovation there is free, but it's more than that. It's also about the length of the program and other things, right?
I think the biggest innovation there that catches a lot of people off guard is that there are no classes. There are no videos. There are no teachers. There are no traditional educational pedagogy.
So then how do I thought the way I would do it is, I mean, not me, but a student would learn by doing little projects, right?
Yeah, so the whole experience project based. So it's very similar to Gum, right? Teacher walks in, says Gum, and walks out. But imagine that over 20 to 30 projects to teach you how to become a product designer. So a great example for that is, one of the first projects in that program is design a 404 page. So it kind of walks you, it's a one pager, walks you through it, and obviously you go to the website and upload your project. But outside of that, you're going to have to go search the web, search Skillshare, talk to some of the other students and figure out how to design.
I see. Okay, this is an innovative approach to it. Now, I could see now why you would have a Discord channel where people can go and talk, and I could see how this is different, and I could see why you'd call it Mavericks. Where's the revenue? How is this helping your business?
Yeah, so we're still thinking through that side, but I do think we will start, we'll charge companies to have access to the graduates. So that way we can keep it free for students. And in New York, so a great example in New York, we just moved to a new office and we used a broker. It was free for us because the building paid for it. And, his incentive was just find us a space that we, wanted. And we knew all of our incentives were aligned, and we hope to do that for students as well.
What do you mean it was free because the building paid for it?
In New York, for offices, companies don't pay the brokers, the building does. So, he shows around, he helped negotiate, the lease. And we hope to do the same thing for students, when they graduate, if they, get an opportunity from Skillshare, from some of our hiring partners, we'll, do career coaching, mentorship, we'll help negotiate so they don't, get underpaid. We'll set them up to be successful, and then we'll charge the companies to hire graduates.
I see. That makes sense. Again, I feel like that's an innovation that came from the coding schools, and the coding schools in many ways have a lot to teach us. And I know at one point years ago, you and Zach from Codecademy got together for an event to talk through education. So I'm sure that you're aware of what they're doing and you're influenced by it. What do you do when you're not working? Let's close it out with that.
Pretty standard stuff. I think, obviously I have a lot of hobbies, but I really enjoy spending a lot of time, I don't know if you read that book, The Five Love Languages, but I rank very high in spending time with people. So I just spend a lot of time with people I care about the most. Cause
doing what? Going out for drinks?
No, it could be anything. It's just having them over for dinner, just catching up with them.
Do you cook when you have people over for dinner?
Yeah, so definitely cook a lot. But it's really about spending quality time with people that you care about, because you realize that those are the relationships that matter in life. Definitely invest a lot into those.
Yeah, I used to do so much more of that before I had kids. And 3 years ago, I had kids, and it's just a lot harder. I tried cooking because I thought it would feel, first of all, more special to invite people to my house, especially like Mixergy interviewees. Now you're coming to – sorry?
It's a lot of work.
And then, it's a lot of work. I do the cooking. I thought it would be more special. I got to tell you. People in our world don't notice it. There's not a single person who said, "Hey, Andrew, I'm impressed that you cooked." Not that I'm looking for praise, but I wanted to see that they noticed it. I don't think there's a single person who even noticed it. So then I said, screw that. I'll just order food in. It's still in my house. All they care about is that there's a closeness of having people in the house.
Yeah, I think that sounds right. And if you plate it, they might not even notice the difference.
No, they don't. You know what I did was I just, before they came, I had the takeout put in pots and pans so you don't see all the takeout material everywhere. It was fine. And then I also played up the fact that it was takeout. I would do Sunday night takeout. Everyone come over to our house. We're just going to order from the Indian place because Indian does a good vegetarian. We keep a vegetarian house. Boom. It's great. I do enjoy that. All right. Congratulations on what you've done with Skillshare. I've watched you guys from the outside. And I've been so curious about what you did, why you did it. And I learned a lot in this interview, and hopefully the audience did too. If they didn't, then first of all, shame on them. And second, they should just go into Skillshare.com. In fact, don't go to Skillshare.com. Go to the App Store, go download the Skillshare app. They have a free trial period too. So you don't even have to pay. You get 30 days to try it. And then apparently you guys suckers are going to pay $15. And I say suckers because I think I'm grandfathered in for 10 a month. But frankly, it's all too cheap. I think that you're underpricing yourself because you've anchored yourself to Spotify. Online education, I think, is worth so much more. It's one of the best values out there, right? A freaking book, even still a book. It blows my mind. I will, with a single book, get a couple of weeks' worth of entertainment for what? $4 on the damn Kindle? 10?
You also got to think about someone spent years of their life to
Right.
all this knowledge into something that is digestible for you to consume, that can, it's all the knowledge you gain from one book is just amazing.
So, meanwhile, Olivia and I went out to a comedy club. It's over $60 a night to go to the comedy club, and we have to eat the crappy food because I can't not eat food if I'm out. And last Friday, we went out to eat dinner somewhere in San Francisco. Actually, it wasn't even dinner. We went out to this interesting bar. I ordered a little bit of food there. Really crappy, oily fish and chips, $60 for what? It was an hour of good conversation. Online education is still one of the best values out there, even at twice the price. All right, Skillshare, guys, don't go to Skillshare.com. Go to Skillshare in your app store. Get the app. Try it for free. What do you got to lose? And you're going to see what online education could be like. And thank you all for listening to Mixergy, where we're also, I think, paving the way in many ways to online education, where you get to learn directly from entrepreneurs like Michael. And finally, I want to thank my two sponsors. If you're looking to host your site, and frankly, you know what? Not if you're looking to host your site. I know I get better results when I promote this to people who hate their hosting companies. I think I deliver more value to people who are not being creative, who need a blank canvas to start a company, start a project. And for you, I urge you to go to hostgator.com/Mixergy. Once you sign up, you're going to find yourself creating new websites and new ideas. And if you want a CRM, guys, let's put down our arms. Not a CRM that's the best of the world and everything, but the CRM that was going to force you through a process that has an end goal, which is closing a sale. Go check out pipedrive.com/Mixergy. All right, Michael, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This has been great.
Killer. And thank you all for listening. Bye, everyone.